Hello, this is Paul Green, WGN political analyst and chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Today we had Terry Mazzani, president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, who talked about the program he is doing with a couple of other funds to create a new way to deal with the problems of the city of Chicago, in fact, the state of Illinois. He talked about the failure, the moral failure of not helping the young, the old, the sick, and that leaving them aside, and talked about the budget not being done in Springfield, where the money for these not-for-profits is not coming their way, and they may go out of business. And lastly, he talked about the biggest issue facing the city and the state was the question of white privilege and overt racism. It was a very intriguing talk.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I could tell a heroic story for virtually every table in the room here with the individuals that are assembled. Very inspiring. I'm grateful that you took your time to be here today. I want to thank the City Club for putting on such an extraordinary lineup of speakers who bring very relevant contemporary issues out into the public. And I want to thank the members of my board who are here. We have Sean Donnelly, Jack Catlin, Mary Richardson Lowry, and Lou Nieto. Thank you all for being here. Now, I was told that this sold out quickly, and then I've realized since that, well, it's because the trust got several of the tables here. And so I'm thrilled that we have so many of our trust staff members who have joined me. Kind of makes me wonder, though, what's happening to the world of philanthropy when we're all here. But you know, I think maybe we'll be able to catch up this afternoon. Because there's so much to talk about. And again, the City Club, this winter and spring, you've just brought a series of speakers and panels that have clearly illuminated the circumstances that vex us. You've been remarkably prescient and in tune with the turbulent times in which we live. And I want to comment on two topics that you would expect, the state of the nonprofit sector and education, and then I will take a road less traveled. In one of his last speeches, Hubert Humphrey remarked that the moral test of a government is how it treats those who are at the dawn of life, the children, those who are at the twilight of life, the aged, and those who are in the shadow of life, the sick and the needy and the handicapped. We are failing that moral test. Those without political power in our state, in our city, our children, our seniors, those with mental illness or disabilities are bearing the full brunt of our dysfunction in deafening silence. Today, I want us to be mindful of their voices. My colleagues, Mark Abristo of Access Living, Wendy DeBow of the United Way, and Rick Estrada of Metropolitan Family Services, they addressed this hardship in great detail about a month ago here. Human service agencies are deep in debt to keep their doors open because the state's not paying its bills. My concern is, what will happen should we go the entire fiscal year without budget appropriations for human services? After July 1st, will these agencies have to write off their accounts payable, plunging many into bankruptcy, causing widespread foreclosures and irreplaceable loss of social sector capacity serving those with the greatest needs in our state? A budget is often referred to as a moral document that sets forth our values as a society. In that case, what does it mean when we have no budget? And what about education? The great public servant John Gardner once stated that what we have before us are some breathtaking opportunities disguised as insolvable problems. For education, we need to bring to bear a different order of thinking to the problems that we face, a different way of facing those problems. Last week, Generation All released its plan for investing in neighborhood schools, a good plan built with community input, but any plans for reform will go for naught if we don't first address the budget crisis facing our schools. the current financial model for CPS is not sustainable. And this is a reality facing many of our nation's urban school districts, such as Detroit, Philadelphia, Newark, New Orleans, Los Angeles. Every year, the liability costs of pensions, health care, aging facilities take a larger bite out of the dollars available for teaching and learning in the classroom. What we need are some new solutions commensurate with the size of the problem. For example, we need a financial solution like the bailout of General Motors during the Great Recession. If you recall, the toxic liabilities were moved into what they called Old Co., and a new General Motors, New Co., was allowed a fresh start. Similarly, if we aggregate the toxic liabilities weighing down CPS and provide it with a fresh start. And we know that this is not just a CPS problem, but it's an epidemic spreading across many of our state school districts. While our state cannot print money the way the federal government did during the recession, it has far superior taxing authority to finance this bailout. We know we're going to have to reinstate the income tax. My vote is to restrict those funds to education. But even with this new infusion of funding, we will still need to tackle the state's inequitable funding formulas. I commend Senate President Cullerton for recognizing this fundamental problem with how we fund our schools and his leadership to do something about it. At the City Club meeting in January, Ellen Alberding, my colleague who leads the Joyce Foundation, she stated that good policy saves lives. To me, equitable education funding is good policy, and it will save lives. Beyond that, we also need to question what it means to be a large urban school district in an era of school choice with a portfolio of providers of education. Given the reality of school choice in our city and in many other large cities, the concept of a school district and even the position of a superintendent needs to be questioned. The truth is that each individual school is on its own in this marketplace of choice, and the structures of centralized command and control are out of date with that reality. What we need instead is a streamlined education authority that would primarily provide honest and objective information about all the schools in Chicago, including charter and private schools. After all, that's what every free market requires, objective data so that the buyers can determine a fair price to pay. Now for the road less traveled. When the trust held its first on the table, we heard loud and clear from the community that race and segregation is the biggest issue we face. Then Heartland Alliance publishes its annual report on poverty, but entitled it, Racism's Toll. I want to commend Evelyn Diaz, the executive director of Heartland, for this brave statement. What if I lived in a neighborhood where 80% of the adults that I knew didn't have a job, where getting through school was a matter of chance, a 50-50 proposition at best, and where getting to school could be life-threatening? Would I still be striving for my share of the American dream? Would I even think the American dream was meant for someone like me? Against all odds, against any standard of reasonableness, our fellow residents who call Inglewood, Austin, or North Lawndale home, they do just that. But for those of us who don't live in those neighborhoods, there is a corrosive narrative that the crisis in our neighborhoods is the result of poverty, and poverty is the result of bad choices. Choosing to drop out of school, choosing to get pregnant while in high school, choosing drugs and gangs over hard work. This allows us to be comfortable with the disparities we see every night on the evening news. Because if we were to look deeper, we would have to confront our unreconciled heritage of racism and white supremacy in this country. Two weeks ago, this room was filled with the words of poet and Third World Press founder Haki Madhubuti, who spoke the impact of racism in our city. But while his 74-year-old body has suffered a lifetime of oppression, he alone does not carry the burden of responsibility to say these things. That responsibility must be shared and said by white people. We must be brave and vocal about racism and white privilege, otherwise the status quo prevails. The reality is we continue to live in one of the most segregated cities in our country with a deep legacy of racism. A few months ago, the Trust in the Chicago Public Library hosted Jim Wallace, pastor and founder of Sojourners, to talk about his powerful new book entitled America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and a Bridge to a New America. Through the lenses of historical events and current tragedies, Wallace asserts an incisive and coherent theological framework for racism as our original sin and a path forward through acts of repentance and action. The title of his book, America's Original Sin, traces the roots of racism in our country to its founding, when we sought to resolve the dissonance between scriptures that state all men are created in God's image and an economy based on slave labor. The result is the compromise embedded in our U.S. Constitution, which calculates population for determining seats in the U.S. House of Representatives based on 3/5 of other persons and excludes Native Americans altogether. With this formulation, the idea of white supremacy is baked into our national DNA, reinforced originally through law and today through a culture of white privilege. So let me propose a different way of thinking about white privilege. There's a famous commencement address delivered in 2005 at Kenyon College by David Foster Wallace. He began his address with a story. Two young fish meet an older fish who ask them, "How's the water?" The younger fish look at each other and say, "What the hell is water?" He goes on to explain the story this way. The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. That is what institutional and structural racism is in our society. It is water. For white people, it is invisible to us because it is our water. Yet in our state, in our city, we provide black and brown children with 3/5 of the funding for their education. Only 3/5 of young black men age 18 to 24 are able to find jobs. Black women are paid 3/5 what white men earn. African Americans experience on average longevity that's 15 years less than whites and Hispanics. We have state-sanctioned oppression, disproportionate laws, and policing that results in 1/3 of all black males having some interaction with our justice system. And African Americans constitute 74% of the victims of police-involved shootings. The forced release of the Laquan McDonald video by Jamie Calvin has been catalytic for social transformation, and I applaud the important role media has played in these events. As Bill Moyers once said, the quality of democracy and the quality of journalism are deeply intertwined. As a result of this coverage, the Police Accountability Task Force was convened and a report produced. To make sure that the recommendations of this report are not lost, I want to draw your attention to the work of Smart Chicago and the City Bureau, who posted a fully annotated and documented listing of all 200 of the recommendations from this report on the Invisible Institute's website. As this report calls out, the intersection with race is undeniable. To quote the report, quote, "If you are not severely and wholeheartedly dealing with racism, you are not going to get to the bottom of this issue," end quote. In response, Fraternal Order of Police President Dean Angelo stated in a recent Sun Times article that, quote, "If you look at crimes and murder, gun, narcotics, and homicide arrests ward by ward, the top 10 wards in the city are over 80% African American. That's where the officers are assigned. That's where more contact occurs. Officers aren't responding to neighborhoods of color. They are responding to neighborhoods of crime," end quote. There it is. That is exactly what Reverend Jim Wallace discusses, the dehumanization and criminalization of African Americans. Let me go back to what Mr. Angelo said. They're responding to neighborhoods of crime, neighborhoods that just happen to be 80% African American. In his view, they are not responding to criminal activity or criminals. They are responding to neighborhoods of crime. Now, here is our dilemma. I'm guessing that Mr. Angelo's statement is very hurtful to African Americans, especially those living in those neighborhoods that he singles out. And a predictable human response would be to lash out and fight back, especially if you have endured generations of sanctioned oppression. But our challenge is to acknowledge the pain and move to reconciliation. For us to make progress in reducing racism in our city and in our police department, Dean Angelo and the FOP must be at the table, all of us on the same side confronting racism, not negotiating across the table with black lives in the balance. So, the death of Laquan McDonald implicates other parts of our society. His educational experiences, or lack thereof, his opportunities for employment, or lack thereof. Unfortunately, we see the pattern of structural racism in the concentrated segregation of Chicago's schools, but we also see glimmers of hope. I want to recognize and applaud the efforts of Ogden International School of Chicago's principal, Michael Bayer, and Jenner Academy of the Arts principal, Robert Croston, who are standing tall in mobilizing their communities to effect a merger of their schools, and they've joined us today here. To extend. So if you don't know, Jenner is an under-enrolled, 100% African-American in low-income school in Cabrini-Green, and the other, Ogden, is a thriving, predominantly white and affluent school. The original proposal for the merger was met with stiff opposition that could be interpreted in no other way than to protect white privilege. But these leaders continue to work with their communities for what is right, and I'm very hopeful that they will complete the merger to the benefit of all children. Their success will be the result of small acts of courage that we can all make. In this case, it's Chris and Sarah Conley, parents of children at Ogden, who are championing the merger of these two schools, and they're joined by what I understand to be the merger moms, which I think is absolutely delightful. So I wish them well. Sarah is able to join us here as well, so thank you for your. As a result of the failures of our education system and our changing labor market, we must also contend with the reality of large numbers of disconnected youth, those out of school and unemployed. A recent study by UIC places this number as high as 50,000 youth, the vast majority being African American. We have dozens of organizations that are trying to do something about this, But in the face of their efforts, the numbers seem to keep increasing. What is needed is a comprehensive commitment by our community that these young people matter, that we are unwilling to give up on them. We know it works. We have Thrive represented here with Sandra. They know what works. It's a matter of the political will to provide the funding required to move from jobs programs that might support 25,000 youth this summer in summer jobs to create tens of thousands of full-time jobs for these 50,000 youth. As a great example of this know-how and can-do spirit is Brenda Palms Barber, Executive Director of the North Lawndale Employment Network. She's here today and has brought with her Elaine Austin and Cornelius Macon, both of whom have successfully overcome challenges and setbacks to earn employment and a living wage. Elaine Austin now devotes her life to helping others to learn from their mistakes. She currently works for Catholic Charities as a Family Works case manager, and Cornelius Macon has turned his life around and is now gainfully employed as manager of frozen foods section at Mariano's on West Halsted. If the three of you would stand up. Unfortunately, the vast majority of ex-offenders cycle back to just a handful of neighborhoods in our city. To expect outcomes to be different for them from the reality of violence plaguing these neighborhoods, it's just crazy. Instead, we need to reprioritize resources and double and triple the size of organizations like the North Lawndale Employment Network so that Brenda can scale her success. And a person who's working to do just that is Arnie Duncan, and I want to acknowledge his leadership to help Chicago in these efforts. And personally, I'm very grateful that he has returned to Chicago and doubled down on his commitment to the most disconnected youth in Chicago. Thank you, Arnie. So, I hope that you are troubled by what I've had to say here today, and I hope that I've disquieted your souls and riled you up a bit. But rather than leaving with hand-wringing and despair, I invite you to engage in actions that can make a real difference. At the Trust, we recognize the urgency of the times we live in, and we're taking bold steps to do our part. Our new strategic plan is organized to address the top priorities identified by our community: racism and segregation, jobs and economic development, and education. We have streamlined our grant making with the General Operating GO grants to reduce the burden on nonprofits that are struggling under the weight of state dysfunction. And on Monday, in partnership with the MacArthur and Calvert Foundations, we announced a new $100 million fund, Benefit Chicago, which is designed to create a flow of low-cost capital to local nonprofits. So you have information at your tables for Benefit Chicago, hot off the presses. This is a direct response to donor demand for innovative tools that drive meaningful and lasting social impact. And believe me, the need is out there. Beyond these institutional responses, there are acts that each of us can take to make a difference. Echoing the Trust's 100th anniversary tagline, "What you do matters," Ellen Alberding made a statement here that it is time to listen to the voices of those whose voices aren't heard. And Jim Wallace echoed this when he said, "We need to first listen up." On May 10th, less than 2 weeks from today, the Trust will be calling our community together for the third installment of On the Table. Our theme, Ideas for Creating a More Unified Chicago. We are pleased that the City Club has devoted its agenda on May 10th to exactly that. But on May 10th, let's do more than just join our friends for a thoughtful and reflective conversation about what it'll take to unify Chicago. Let's be the change we want to see and actually start looking more like a unified Chicago. Go out of your way to integrate your on-the-table conversations. Include people you don't know. Make new, diverse friends. Let's unify Chicago at least on one day, one meal at a time. Let's make that the Chicago way. You have in your places these boxes. They are the host kits for On the Table to help give you a head start here. And Daniel Ash and Cheryl Hughes will be pleased to help you with that. But in conclusion, several weeks ago, State Treasurer Michael Frerichs delivered a decidedly upbeat message to this body, even though he has every right to preach doom and gloom as State Treasurer. But instead, he stressed over and over again that Illinois is a great state with a bright future. I will add a corollary to his mantra: Chicago is a great city with a bright future. That is our vision of hope to sustain us all, to become comfortable discussing and confronting racism, to seek reconciliation, and to work toward a more inclusive future. In closing, I'll come full circle to the moral test that we face. Robert F. Kennedy said it best: moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Thank you.
If you have questions, Miss Amanda is over here. Jack's back there. Don't be ashamed, because it's clearly every time we have someone from a big agency like this, no one raises their hand. Too busy getting out the RFP. So that's the only one I'm doing.
That's it.
That's it, Jen. However, I have to commend you, Terry, because most of the people you quote have spoken at the City Club. So if you're not a member of the City Club, you're really missing out on an awful lot. Here, Jack, wind your way through. Nothing? Well, looking at all the questions, here we go. Eric Weinheimer from Forefront. What does the Trust expect to come out of the on-the-table conversations? What's next?
Thank you, and I do want to commend Eric on his leadership, the transition from Donors Forum to Forefront. They're a rock-solid partner for our nonprofit sector here in Chicago. So what we have experienced with On the Table is it does create an opportunity for our community to come together in civic dialogue. And as a result of these experiences, we are convinced in the power of individuals meeting, identifying solutions. We plan to back that up this year with a new set of grants. So this is the breaking news portion here that our board just approved last week, called Acting Up Grants, that make small amounts of funding available to these mealtime conversations to drive to action. So that we see more of the ideas taking root and showing that community residents indeed can transform Chicago to a more inclusive place to live.
Anyone else? Going once, going twice?
I got one.
Alderman, I know it's, sometimes it's tough to write them down. Remember... From the Fighting 49th Ward, Alderman Joe Moore. Based on your tenure at CPS... Oh, glad we waited for this one. Based on your tenure at CPS, what idea do you have to avoid teacher strike? Is that word?
Yeah, I had to write it really
I understand. Were you here last week for Karen Lewis?
Yes, I was.
All right. Knock it out in 25 words or less.
The challenges with the Chicago Public Schools and Teacher Union are really a microcosm of the larger polarization that we're experiencing for that. And I know that both parties are working very hard to reach a resolution. Maybe a revolution would be good, too. We could hope for that. A little slip there. And, you know, it's a really delicate time, not for me to weigh in on, but just for everybody to recognize that they're up against insurmountable odds with so much uncertainty. Typically, when you go into bargaining, the parties have some givens. They know what budgets are, they know what revenues are, they know what expenses are. Everything is a moving target in this. So I think it's hard for any party to feel what have a sense of what would be a fair and respectful resolution there. And so the larger context is simply creating the uncertainty and turbulence. And so yeah, we need other decisions to be made so that they can get on and do their job.
Okay, how about a round of applause for our speaker?